on to the Rambam. We'll see what actually happens. So, last time we studied the position of the Rambam on Hashkacha. We saw his comments on 3:17 and 18, where he distinguished between people and animals, and also between the righteous who cleave to God and others, and are thus sometimes subject to nature. We saw how the Rambam understands that hashkacha occurs naturally due to a tzaddik's connectedness to God. We saw in 3:51 how, therefore, the Rambam explains that those that are extraordinarily righteous insofar as they're constantly cleaving to God will not be subject at all to the whims of nature. And the Rambam gave a path for everyone to grow in that level and become more and more connected to the Ribbono Shel Olam, such that, among other things, they will be afforded this protection. Now, we're going to go back a little bit to Chelek Gimel, Perek Chaf Gimel, where the Rambam discusses the story of Eov. According to the Rambam, the book of Eov is really a machlokas about hashkacha, and the various characters in the story. The Rambam seems to accept the position that of one of the opinions in Bava Basra, that it was a mashal lo hay v'lo nivra, but the positions of the various characters in the story reflect the different views of hashkacha that the Rambam presented in the beginning of 3:17. If you recall, we saw that there were those who argued for extreme hashkacha, there are those that argued for very limited hashkacha, and the dialogue in this story, and the Rambam carefully reads many of the psukim and shows how this is so, relate to those different views. And the Rambam maintains that Eov initially held that the view of Aristotle is correct, and we'll see how his position changed throughout the story. So if you look at the supplemental packets from last week, it's the paragraph beginning Job's opinion on this. Again, these are also in the bigger packets with the whole context. We're just going to be looking at it one piece at a time. So this is the top of page 4. Again, if anyone came in late, these are from last week, but there are more up here. So Eov's opinion on this is that this happening proves that the righteous man and the wicked are regarded as equal by him, may he be exalted, because of his contempt for the human species and abandonment of it. Right? Remember, Aristotle maintained that there's no hashkacha pratis, perhaps only hashkacha klalis, but not hashkacha pratis. So Eov says, look, I know I'm a righteous person, I have a tzind, yet I'm suffering. This is evidence that there is no hashkacha pratis. Very simple. This is what he says in all speeches. It is all one. Therefore, I say he destroys the innocent and the wicked. If the flood slay suddenly, he will mock at the calamity of the guiltless. He says thus, that if a torrent comes suddenly, killing all those it meets and sweeping them away, he laughs, he meaning God, laughs at the calamity of the innocent, right? Because, like we said, if Aristotle is right, then it makes sense that a storm could come and kill someone who's totally innocent. There is no hashkacha pratis, and that it was initially Eov's view, as many psukim attest to. So what happens? Towards the end of the book, there is two significant things that happen. Number one is Elihu comes and says something which is apparently different than that which was said by the first three friends who visit. And then Eov has the vision in the whirlwind. And after that, Eov comes to a true understanding of providence. So the question is, what changes? So the Rambam explains that God's revelation in the whirlwind constituted true knowledge of God. Now, what does that mean? So the Ram actually relates very much to Parshas HaShavua, as we'll see in a second. Until that point, Eov's understanding of God was dependent upon what other people had told him. Meaning to say, he did not have a personal connection or a personal understanding. People had told him certain things about God. He read certain things. And the Rambam maintains that all knowledge that is indirect is deficient. To appreciate this, we'll talk a little bit about Parshas HaShavua, and then we'll return to the story of Eov. The Rambam, Kayadua, maintains that Anochi is a mitzvah saseh, the mitzvah of Emunah, or perhaps more precisely, Yediyah, of God's existence. He explains this in Sefer Mitzvos at the beginning of Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah and in other places. The Rambam in Sefer Mitzvos proves this from the Gemara in Makos that says there are Taryag Mitzvos, Torah Tzivalanu Moshe, Torah's Gematria 611, so Hashem commanded them 611 Mitzvos, whereas Anochi and Lo Yiyah are directly heard from Hashem. So you see that the Gemara is taking for granted that Anochi is a mitzvah, and this proves that it should be counted among the Taryag Mitzvos, as opposed to the view of the Bahag, who didn't count it for whatever reason. The Ramban challenges Rambam, even though, as you're going to point out in his Pirshah HaTorah, in this week's Parsha, he seems to accept the Rambam's view that it is a mitzvah, but in Sefer Mitzvahs, where he defends the Bahag, so he offers a number of challenges. One of them is, what would the purpose of a mitzvah of Emunah be? After all, if you believe, then you believe. If you don't believe, so commanding someone to believe doesn't make too much sense. That question could be resolved in a number of ways. Among other things, the Rambam maintains that a person, as we discussed earlier in the year, should search for proof, and proof is possible, according to the Rambam. There are other aspects of the answer as well. But the Ramban also challenges Rambam on technical grounds. And one of his challenges is that if your proof is Gemara in Makos, that Anochi and Lo Yiyah are Mepi HaGvura Shmanum, so how many mitzvos are in Anochi and Lo Yiyah? Probably 4 or 5, right, according to Rambam's own minion. So, if we heard those two dibros from Hashem, so then it shouldn't say there were 2 dibros from Hashem and 611 from Moshe. It should say there were 4 or 5. Now, Mineu Be, that's Akasha on the Gemara, though the Ramban is less bothered by that. He thinks the Gemara is an Asmachta. But for the Rambam, this is a big problem, because this is the Raya that Anochi is a mitzvah. So the Or Sameach points out that the answer, the Or Sameach thinks that the answer of most of the kashas on the Rambam can be solved by learning Mar Nevuchim. And here too, he does that all over the place. And here too, if you study Mar Nevuchim, you'll see it's not a kasha. Why? The Rambam writes in Mar Nevuchim a fascinating thing. He says that what exactly is meant by Anochi and Eliyah, meaning being Mipi HaGvura Shma'anum. Does that mean literally we heard those two sentences? The Rambam seems to assume the answer is no. That's impossible, because nevuah is only possible for a person who has reached a certain madrega, and Klal Yisrael as a whole did not reach the madrega of prophecy. So what is meant? What is meant is something else, which is the following. That Anochi and Lo Yiyah are things that could be proven. God's existence. God's existence is something that we know, not just because we've heard it from the Mesorah or the like, but it's something that we could know firsthand. We could prove it. As such, our knowledge of those concepts is direct knowledge, as opposed to our knowledge of the other mitzvos, which is indirect knowledge. What do I mean it's indirect? How do we know it? We know it through Moshe. We know the other mitzvos because Hashem told Moshe, Moshe told us. But our knowledge of God's existence and the non-existence of any other fundamental power, in other words, Anochi and Lo Yiyah, is direct. It's not based off of anything else. And therefore, Anochi and Loya are mipi agvura shmanum. And that's why it is not four or five mitzvos, the Orsa Meach points out, but just Anochi and Loya. Now, of course, you're probably wondering, what about the Rambam, who also says in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah that our belief in the truth of Torah stems from our having personally experienced revelation at Sinai. It's not based off of miracles, because after all, anytime someone sees miracles, they at least could have a tinge of doubt. Maybe after all it was magic or something else. So if you read the Rambam carefully, it's not here at all, because we did hear the kol. You have to understand what the Rambam means by kol, but we all experienced the kol. It was just not undifferentiated sound. And moreover, if you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, when he mentions the point that we all experienced revelation at Sinai, he doesn't say what we heard were the words of Anochi Hashem Elokecha. He says we heard Hashem telling Moshe, Lechem Or Lehem Kach V'Kach, which means that we personally saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicate to Moshe, and therefore we knew the truth of prophecy and the truth of Torah in a direct way, even if we didn't hear the specific words. All this is another topic. I'm just telling you the Kitzer Rosh HaPrakim now. Perhaps another time we could go back to Rambam's understanding of Ma'amad Har Sinai, which is very important to understand, but not for now. The point that we want to take from this is the following, that direct knowledge, according to the Rambam, is much more powerful than indirect knowledge. So our knowledge of God's existence is direct. There's no difference between our knowledge of God's existence and Moshe's knowledge of God's existence, because we could prove it. It's direct knowledge. It's not through an intermediary. Whereas with respect to the other mitzvos, so that we only know through an intermediary, namely through Moshe. That's the Mahalach that the Rambam says. Now, what does that have to do with Eov? So the Rambam says that Eov initially only knew of God indirectly. This reflects a low level of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What happened in the tempest was that that Eov's understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was direct. Okay, so that's what happened. He attained personal knowledge of God, and with it, absolute certainty. And this caused his understanding of providence to change. That's what changed. I see a lot of questions. Let me just finish the way the Rambam explains Eov, and Belina Adair, I hope to address your questions. Now, to fully appreciate this, the Rambam says you have to understand and look carefully at the Torah's description of Eov at the beginning of the Sefer. The Sefer opens off with the Pasuk telling us there was a man who lived in the land of Uz, and his name was Eov, and he was sincere, and he was upright, and he was Yari Shamayim, and he shunned evil. The Rambam notes the Torah speaks very highly of Eov, but it omits a very important thing. It doesn't say that he was intelligent. It doesn't say that he was wise. There's Yari Shamayim, but there was no Chachma. And the whole story of Eov, according to the Rambam, explains how Eov grows through the process of his suffering and emerges with a correct understanding of providence, something that he initially lacked. So let's try to explain that a little more. How do we explain this transformation? So, part of it relates to the approach that Rambam has towards Hashgacha that we explained last week. So Elihu, whose view is correct, helps Eov arrive at this truth. And he tells him several times that during a person's life, an angel may rescue him from evil circumstances into which he has fallen. Let's take a look at that pasuk. It's the second source on page 4. Ki v'achas yidaber kel uvishtayim lo yeshurena v'chalom chazion laila binfol tardema al anashim bisnumos ale mishkav az yigale ozen anashim uvim soram yachtom lasir adam ma'asef. So for God knows in one way and in two to one who does not see it. In a dream, a vision of the night when sound sleep falls upon men, in the slumbers on the bed, then he opens the ear of men, and with their chastisement he seals them to restrain man from a deed. So remember Rambam's description last week of how Hashem protects the tzaddik from boarding that moribund ship, not by supernatural intervention in the sense of a nace which prevents the ship from sinking or the tzaddik from dying, but rather to allow the tzaddik to realize the ship's unworthiness and allowing him to reconsider his venture. So that's what the pasuk is saying over here, that the tzaddik will be protected by an angel once or twice, meaning to say he's going to have some type of apprehension. God is going to cause his ear to notice, his eyes to see, and thereby restrain man from a dream. Okay, so far, the approach is very similar to what we saw last week. However, the Rambam now adds some very important things. In the vision of the tempest, Hashem basically tells Eov that you can't understand providence. You can't understand the way in which I act in the world. It's full of a series of questions, of unanswered questions. Where were you when I made the world? And how could you understand or expect to understand these mysterious things like Leviathan and the like? What are you thinking, Eov? You, a human being, you think you could understand everything I do? You're finite, I'm infinite, you're limited in your wisdom and your apprehension, and therefore, with this, you can, you should not expect to understand nature. And the Rambam, or HaKadosh Baruch Hu, describes in this vision the perplexity of nature. Take a look at the next paragraph. The purpose of all these things is to show that our intellects do not reach the point of apprehending how these natural things that exist in the world of generation and corruption are produced in time, and conceiving how the existence of the natural force within them has originated them. They are not things that resemble what we make, meaning the things God makes are not like the things we make. How then could we wish that his governance of and his providence for them should resemble our governance of and providence for the things that we govern and provide for? Meaning to say, when a person sees suffering and questions God's actions, so what are they doing? They're saying, well, if I would have made a world and I would have made people and animals or the like, then I would not have allowed the righteous person to suffer like this. So Hashem's telling him, okay, that's true. If you would have done it, then you would have done that. But the way in which I think, ki lo machshavosai machshavoseichem, velo darcheichem derachai, the way I think, the way I create is not like the way you would create, and therefore, rather, it is obligatory to stop at this point and believe that nothing is hidden from him. So, first of all, your questions, Eov, your questions of the justice and the nature of my providence are foolish. Okay, that's important, right? We don't really understand what's going on. And then the Rambam adds the secret to understanding and dealing with why it is that sometimes the righteous suffer. So he concludes with a remarkable statement. To fully appreciate this, we have to recall what we saw earlier, which is that the Rambam delineates three types of evil. We referred to this last time. Evil caused by nature, perhaps metaphysical evil. What that means is that just by dint of our being physical beings, there's going to be some type of pain and suffering and the like. Number two, evil that people bring upon each other, natural evil, social evil, wars, fighting, and the like. And finally, number three, evil that a person brings upon themselves, personal evils and things that could have been avoided, right? You eat too much shawarma for supper, so you're going to get a stomachache, or you might live shorter because you'll die of a heart attack or whatever it is. So the first type of evil is a result of our being natural beings. And the Rambam in Chelek Gimel Perek Yud Beis writes that the justification of this sort of evil is that it is necessary for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to carry out his plans. It's foolish for a person to ask, it should have been otherwise. The way he puts it over there is, he who wishes to be endowed with flesh and bones and at the same time not be subject to impressions and not be attained by any of the concomitants of matter, merely wishes, without being aware of it, to combine two contraries, two opposites, namely to be subject to impressions and not to be subject to them. Put differently, to be human necessitates being subject to degradation and corruption, which by definition involves some type of pain and suffering. What do you want? Would you think it's better that human beings not be material beings, that they be angels? Well, then we wouldn't have free will. The whole purpose of our existence would be gone. Well, then you say, okay, so we should have free will. We should have that physical body and have the choice of choosing between right and wrong. Well, if that's the case, then you can't possibly expect not to be subject to the harms that come along with having a physical body. You want to say you want the best of both worlds. That's impossible. Now, that's the first category of evil, and that's why it exists. And that's why to expect something else is unreasonable. And that notion is what Hashem is telling him in the in this vision. The second category of evils results from people acting inappropriately towards each other on an individual as well as a societal level. And the third category relates to people not taking care of themselves. So the second and the third category, the Rambam says actually most evils come from there. And the truth is that these are avoidable. Regarding the third class, if you take care of yourself, so you won't be subject to those types of evils. If you follow the Rambam's advice in Hilchos Deos and, you know, never eat more than you're two-thirds full, so you'll be very healthy. In terms of the second category of evils, if a person and certainly a society follows Torah and mitzvos and the like, then those won't exist. Well, what about the first? So the first, the Rambam said, that, well, that's sort of natural and a result of our being physical beings. Now, the Rambam writes, that being the case, you're wondering about why the nature of evil. So he says the vast majority of evil comes from the second the first and the the first two classes of evil, right? The latter two classes relate to man's free will. In a sense, they're avoidable. And he writes that the first two classes of evil are quite rare. Most of the pain and suffering comes from the third class, meaning to say an individual can protect himself from that. If you live life making intelligent choices. Right, again, the third class is basically harm we cause ourselves. And he says that if you make good choices, so you'll avoid harming yourself, and as such you'll be spared most evils. So it's a fascinating question, because, you know, is that really true? Even if a person takes very good care of themselves, will all people who do so be spared of most evils? Let's look at the Rambam's life himself, right? The Rambam, we read about this last week, had to flee from Spain due to persecution of the Almohads, and sojourn for 20 years of his life wandering around due to the second class of evils. Right? I don't think that there's anything that Rambam could have done to avoid that. So imagine, you know, having to flee your home, run away, wander around for 20 years. All that because of what? Because the crazy Almohads. So that's clearly an example of the second class of evil. So how could we really say that, well, if you make good choices, you'll be protected from that for the most part? So the answer to this question lies in understanding what the Rambam writes over here about dealing with pain and suffering. And the Rambam writes over here in describing the apprehension of Eov that while some pain is inevitable, most of the distress that a person experiences due to these travails is due to their attitude and their response to these travails, not due to the inherent pain that these travails cause. It's not due to the evil, and as such, it falls under category 3, meaning to say if a person would know and have the proper attitude, then the types of things that befall them would not cause them so much pain and suffering. And the reason why they do experience so much pain and suffering when these things happen to them is because they have the wrong attitude. So the Rambam writes, once man, this is the next paragraph on page 4, once man realizes this, that a human cannot fathom the divine, it will be simple for him to bear any and all suffering. His agonies will not generate doubts concerning God, whether he is aware or not aware, whether he watches or does not. They will, on the contrary, only serve to increase his love of God. As we read at the end of the vision, therefore, meaning Eov's vision, therefore I revile all that I valued before, and I have reconciled myself to the dust and ashes in which, because of my illness, I wallowed. And this accords with the teaching of the sages concerning the religious grandeur of those who serve God out of love and rejoice in suffering. The Rambam is saying that Eov experienced so much pain and suffering when he lost his material possessions and even his health and even his children because he had the wrong attitude towards those things. A person with the right attitude will not experience depression when these things are taken away from them, because they are not what is ikar, they are not what is eternal. And therefore the suffering that a person experiences comes from incorrect values. And that's what Eov lacked originally. Because remember, although he was very righteous, he was not wise. He didn't have the correct value system. It's his incorrect value system that caused him to start wondering about whether there's providence when he started experiencing these pains that he felt were unjust. So the Rambam says, basically, the lesson of the book of Eov, and that this answers our question, right? What was our question? Isn't it true that lots of people suffer a great deal in their life, let's say due to category 2? Why does Rambam say everything is based off of category 3? answer is that, yeah, difficulties will arise for a person due to category two. But that doesn't mean that they will be experienced as suffering if they have the correct attitude. And as such, to a certain degree, they could be seen as bad things happening to them. Sorry, as such, they should be categorized as category three, as they're bringing the harm upon themselves. Because it's not the event that causes the pain, it's the attitude that causes the pain. And the Rambam says, therefore, true happiness stems from our connection to the Ribbono Shel Olam, our apprehension of the truth, being mizdabek to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if a person, that is always in a person's power, to be mizdabek to Hashem. And if a person is mizdabek to Hashem, then they'll be sameach b'yisurin, as Chazal tell us. What does it mean, sameach b'yisurin? Nobody's happy when they get yisurin, but it means, the Rambam says, that they won't be shtered by the yisurin because they have that correct attitude. They know what's truly valuable. So a person could have a lot of money and then lose all that money. The tzaddik will be sameach b'yisurin, because the tzaddik understands that true simcha comes not from material possessions, not even from health, not even from family. It comes from being mizdabik to Hashem. The Rambam always talks about how simcha comes from avas Hashem. And avas Hashem comes from understanding Hashem and being mizdabik to Hashem. And if a person has that attitude, then you could throw at him all the mud in the world, but he'll be sameach b'yisurin. And that happened. Yov apprehended that when he came to know God directly. The next quote: while he had known God only through traditional stories and not by way of speculation, Yov had imagined that the things thought to be happiness, such as health, wealth, and children, are the ultimate goal. For this reason, he fell into such perplexity and said such things as he did. The blasphemy that Eov said, the denial of Hashkacha, stemmed from the fact that he had the wrong values. But once you understand that true knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the basis for true happiness, so then a person, to a large degree, is immune from pain and suffering caused by the misfortunes in this world. Now, this is a very different approach to explaining why the righteous suffer than that which we saw last week. Last week, in 351, we read about how, why would righteous suffer? Only because they stop for a moment apprehending the divine. They're meisiach das from being mizdabik to Hashem. But a tzaddik will never suffer. Nothing bad could ever happen to a person as long as they're constantly clinging to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And here, he seems to be giving a different answer. Now, another point I want to just parenthetically mention is the following. Before we get to figuring out, resolving the stira, and taking all your questions, is it really possible to do what the Rambam says? Right? We're only flesh and bones. Cerebral knowledge doesn't always define our emotional reactions. Now, the Rambam seems to be saying, yes, it is possible. It might be a very high madrega. I know I'm certainly very far from that. And the Rambam expresses this in a number of places. First of all, in Hilchos Avel, Perek Yud Gimel, Halacha Yud Aleph, the Rambam declares that excessive mourning or sadness is foolish because death is natural. In a letter that he wrote in 1191 to his Talmud, Yosef ibn Aknin. He writes, I've already notified you that David's little daughter passed away. May God grant that her death be atonement for her. My son, I enjoin you not to mourn or grieve and demise it of any individual, male or female. In accordance with divine wisdom, it is incumbent upon us to focus the notion of goodness upon the permanent existence of man rather than upon an individual. And basically tells him, like, you know, doesn't make sense to get very sad. We quoted 2 weeks ago the Rambam's Mahalich in Avelos. Avelos is supposed to be not sadness due to grief, but tshuva. It's avodas Hashem. So again, the Rambam seems to say that if a person is proper values, so then he'll be spared any type of at least excessive sadness due to personal loss. Now, what's interesting is that the Rambam himself writes that this was not always his personal experience. In 1177, so this is written close to 20 years, 15 years before the letter we just read, Rambam basically writes about the depression that he experienced after the loss of his brother, David, who died in a shipwreck. He writes, "The greatest misfortune that has befallen me during my entire life," all these letters, by the way, could be seen in the big source books. I'll just read it to you now. "Worse than anything else was the demise of the saint who drowned while journeying on the Indian Ocean. With him went down a considerable fortune belonging to us and others. On the day I received the terrible news, I fell ill and remained in bed for about a year, suffering from a sore boil, fever, and depression, and was almost given up. Close to 8 years have now elapsed, and I still mourn for him, and there is no consolation. My greatest joy was to see him. Now every joy has been dimmed. He has passed away and left me confounded in a strange land. Whenever I see this his handwriting on one of his sfarim, my heart turns upside down and my grief reawakens." And he concludes this letter that, "Lule Torascha Shashuai, if it wasn't for the Torah, that's my delight and philosophy. So to divert my grief, I would have surely succumbed to my afflictions." Now, the contrast between these two letters is astonishing. And I think that there's no doubt that Rambam didn't forget his own personal grief when he's writing to his Talmud, Yosef ibn Aknin. So what's the pshat? So I think the pshat is that two things. Number one is the Rambam would have acknowledged that emotional weakness does, and this is something that he frequently stresses, reflect a incomplete internalization of the truth. And to some degree, the Rambam would have seen this as a shortcoming. And the context indicates that. At the same time, and I think this is also true, the Rambam seems to acknowledge that sometimes depression is extraordinarily difficult and cannot fully be controlled. And Rambam remarkably doesn't shy away from acknowledging that in recollecting his own experiences. The Rambam doesn't say that I'm proud of what I happened to me and this is the appropriate response to terrible things happening, but the Rambam acknowledges that we are humans And perhaps anyone who isn't absolutely perfect will still struggle with and sometimes succumb to this. Rambam is at once very realistic, but also someone who thinks that a human being is capable of achieving the most lofty of accomplishments, like he explains in 351, constantly being mizdabek to Hashem, and like he says over here in 323, reaching a state where suffering won't cause a person pain. Okay, that being the case, so now let's summarize some of the contradictions within the view of the Rambam concerning Hashgacha and see if they actually are contradictions. So let's summarize some of the problematic points. Concerning providence, we've seen Rambam make four assertions. Number one, in 317, he writes, absolutely, there is justice. This is what we saw the first week when we did the Rambam. Nobody will ever suffer unjustly. Tzadik v'yasharhu. Number two, in 317 and 318, he maintains that providence is naturalistic through the intellect connecting to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Accordingly, a righteous person who is constantly connected to God Someone who's not constantly connected to God will naturally be left to the whims of nature and accordingly suffer. He elaborates on this. Number three, he elaborates on this in 351, where he describes that protection is guaranteed only when a person is contemplating upon the divine. There is another, even though both of those points, the same point is made in 317, 18, and 351, there's a slight difference in the sense that 351 sounds like you'll be protected from anything bad happening if you're the tzaddik who's always contemplating Hashem, whereas in 317, 318, he says someone who's the tzaddik who connects to Hashem is not going to be subject to nature, but they'll be subject to reward and punishment based off of what they deserve. In other words, can something bad happen to a person thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu? 317, 318, he says yes, though it will be an onesh. 351 sounds like he'll be totally spared. Final statement number four, in 323, when treating Eov and his suffering, he seems to conclude that even someone who intellectually connects to Hashem will suffer misfortunes and will have to endure affliction despite that divine overflow. However, the afflictions that befall such a person will not cause them to suffer because they've acquired a personal and direct knowledge of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and will have correct perspective on these matters. So, where does that leave us? So, assertions 2, 3, and 4 seem to contradict 1. Statement 1 was, no injustice will ever befall a person. And statements 2, 3, and 4 imply that injustice might befall a person if they're not connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu constantly. Assertion 4 seems to contradict assertions 2 and 3, because assertion 4 seems to imply that harm will befall even a righteous person. He just won't experience that pain and suffering because he has the proper attitude, whereas assertions 2 and 3 sound like the righteous person will never be afflicted by nature. So what's the pshat? And moreover, there also seems to be a little bit of a contradiction in terms of the incomprehensibility of providence. In 323, he writes that Eov's great epiphany was that suffering is sometimes unfathomable. But in 351, he writes that he had this great revelation, which answers all the questions, namely, suffering will only happen when a person has hesach hadas from thinking about a Kodesh Baruch Hu. So, we're not the first person to be bothered by these questions. Reb Shmuel Ibn Tibon, who was Rambam's translator, wrote a letter to the Rambam in 1199, bothered by some of the above questions. The way he understood the steer was as follows. Ibn Tibon understood that 323 indicates that there's no hashkacha. No hashkacha at all. 323 says, you want to know how to deal with suffering? Just realize that it can't really hurt you. Sticks and stones might break your bones, but they can never cause you any suffering and pain. And Ibn Tibon also understands, that's what Rambam meant in chapter 17, when he writes that a person who has perfected his intellect will not suffer due to mikra. Doesn't mean he'll never be left to mikra, according to Ibn Tibon. It means that mikra will never bother him. But then he writes, this contradicts 351, where the Rambam states that a person who's constantly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be spared from all mikra. So basically, Ibn Tibon understood that chapters 3:16 to 23 is saying providence for the perfected individual, like Eof post-revelation, only provides intellectual immunity from evil and suffering, but the later chapter, 351, implies total protection. So Ibn Tibon writes Rambam a letter. He writes that he's a Navoch, trying to understand this resolution. He suggests several possibilities, but turns to the Rambam for guidance. And we actually have his letter. We can look at part of it over here, page 4. Kol asher amar adunenu yarum hodo sheba'ot shelo, repeated word there, yada habore yediya amitis bo'u alav osam haraos, aval achar sheyada Hashem lo haya efshar sheyavo alav raos. V'zehu asher amar adunenu b'par kavbeis ilu haya hu chacham lo chashash bo'u alav shum davar mikol ma sheba. Okay, and he asked these questions. So, what did Rambam answer? It would be nice to know. We don't have Rambam's response to Ibn Tibon's letter or the like. There were at least three letters that correspondences between Ibn Tibon and Rambam. One concerns translation and interpretation. And we have the response to that letter. We'll read from it in a moment. And the other two letters, we know that there was at least one more response from the Rambam, but we don't know what it was. In terms of Ibn Tibon's letter, we have this one. So, but at least we'll read a little bit from Rambam's response to one of Ibn Tibon's letters. Ibn Tibon, as I mentioned, was a translator of the Rambam, and he wrote to the Rambam asking him for help in terms of translation. And he had a bunch of questions, and the Rambam responded to Ibn Tibon that, so Ibn Tibon says, I'd love to travel from Provence to Mitzrayim and ask these questions personally. I have so many questions on the Mor Nevuchim, please let me ask you them. And the Rambam responds, we can't read it inside now, you have it at the bottom of page 4, that basically, don't bother coming to visit me because I don't have any time to see you. And he tells him a little bit about his schedule. This is his schedule at the end of his life, or the latter half of his life. If his schedule is like this his whole life, then he never would have learned any Torah. And we would never have the Rambam. But anyway, basically says, like, I'm all busy all day taking care of people and the like. I barely have time to think and learn, and I teach Torah and the like, but you could come. It'd be a big waste of time for you to come to visit me and ask me your questions because I don't have time to talk to you. Okay, so for better or for worse, we don't know what the Rambam would have answered to Ibn Tibon's questions. Now, Ibn Tibon's preferred explanation to the Rambam in this letter is to resolve this contradiction by assuming that Rambam really accepted Aristotle's view. And he has to read a lot of what the Rambam writes in a rather creative light, because if you recall, we read the Rambam explicitly state that Aristotle's view is wrong, and it's against the Torah. But he says whatever he says, and he doesn't really mean what he said in 351, and he really means only some what he says in 17, v'chule v'chule. Ibn Tibbon's reading is very problematic. If you remember from the first semester, we talked about esoteric interpretations of the Rambam, people who basically try to say that the Rambam doesn't mean what he says a lot of the time. Among modern commentaries, there are others who also accept Ibn Tibbon's view. Shlomo Pinis, in his introduction, also thinks that Rambam holds of Aristotle's view. There are other ancient commentaries and other modern commentaries that take this view, Ibn Kaspi and the like. But as we talked about then, that's not our Mahalich, and others as well. We'll see next week probably how the Ramban reads Rambam. He also didn't understand it like Ibn Tibbon. And the truth of the matter is, I don't think that there's really much of a contradiction at all. The simple reading of 317 corresponds to 351 precisely. I don't know why Ibn Tibbon says that. In fact, throughout the whole work, including 323, he accepts his theory in 317 and 18 that one who constantly connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be spared all suffering. Eov's suffering resulted from the fact that he wasn't connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and as such, he was subject to suffering. Now, what about the lesson that he says at the end of 323? That if you understand, if you have the proper values, you won't suffer. The answer to that is very simple, which is that the lesson that Eov discovers is very important for everybody to understand. And that's because most people, almost everybody, will never be entirely spared from suffering. Remember, the Rambam 351 says only people like the Avos, Moshe Rabbeinu, who constantly were thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu even when they were engaged in the world, are absolutely spared from all suffering. So Eov's lesson is A, true, and B, very important to be aware of and internalize for everybody but people who are constantly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't say in any way that the person who is constantly connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu will still be subject to nature. He doesn't say that. He just says that someone who does experience pain and suffering will know how to deal with that pain and suffering if they understand the truth. And therefore, it's very important to understand. So 323 does not contradict 317 or 351. Rather, it highlights another important lesson to always be aware of in terms of dealing with adversity. So the question that Ibn Tibbon actually asks, I don't see it as all problematic. Resolving the contradiction about justice is a bit more difficult. Because on the one hand, the Rambam does repeatedly reaffirm his absolute belief in divine justice. But on the other hand, the Rambam writes that most people are sometimes subject to nature, which presumably yields unjust results. So while the chassid will never suffer unjustly, many people will. So how do we resolve that? So one possibility is to suggest that such people do suffer justly because their experiences are fair, a fair consequence of their failure to utilize the magnificent gift bestowed upon them. Meaning to say, since each and every person has the ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and thus be spared from Mikra, and not only that, but the Rambam even provides for you guidance how to reach that level, including basically keeping Torah and mitzvot. So therefore, if you are left to Mikra and suffer accordingly, that's your fault, because you could have done better. However, I think this solution is hardly satisfying, because some people do experience tortuous pain, and their failure to take advantage of God's invitation hardly accounts for their searing agony. And I think the Rambam isn't saying that it does. Another suggestion would be to say, we alluded to this in the first week, that maybe Hashem intervenes to prevent unjust suffering. In other words, Kadosh Baruch Hu leaves most people to nature, if they're not connecting to Hashem. But that's because the suffering that they experience is deserved, because they're not tzaddikim gemurim. They've done wrong things. And as such, it is just for them to experience the suffering that they experience. But lu yitzir, somebody due to nature was about to experience something totally unjust and unfair, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu would intervene and prevent that from taking place. This solution also, I think, is not in keeping with the tone of what the Rambam says, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu intervenes naturalistically, not supernaturalistically, and certainly not on a regular basis. So I don't think that answer is correct either. Another possible solution is to deny that there's injustice. Well, it seems like the righteous are sometimes suffering. In fact, whatever pain that they experience is just and has some type of purpose. But that too is clearly incorrect. The Rambam rejected that view when he was rejecting the view of the Mutazila, right, last time, who made this suggestion. He said, what do you mean? The person who's born with some type of disease that plagues them their whole life, that's really for their best, and that's just? So what is the answer? Seems to me that the Rambam maintains that in fact there are times when the innocent suffer due to exposure to nature. How could this be? Rambam writes that God is just and he never causes suffering to those unjustly. And the answer is that he categorically, when we look back at 3:17, he categorically rejects the possibility that God would cause a person to suffer unjustly, even if it's to reward them in Olam Haba, Yisur and Shalava. However, it's not the case that someone who suffers due to nature is suffering, that God is directly causing their suffering. And that's because, as we saw in the Rambam in chapter 12, there are various sources of evil in the world, and in his infinite and incomprehensible wisdom, the Rambam created the world in such a way where these evils exist, where nature exists, and as such, people will sometimes be subject to nature. So Hashem, and this is what the Rambam rejects, would never directly cause a person to suffer unjustly. But the fact that Hashem creates nature, and sometimes due to nature people suffer unjustly, is not, according to Rambam, a violation of Tzadik V'Yashar Hu. At the same time, according to the Rambam, a person can transcend those natures, those natural evils, by connecting to God, and as such, he won't be subject to happenstance. Most people could do this, or do this, while praying and studying Torah, and extraordinary people do it even while engaged in the mundane. And for those who don't reach that madrega, so then they can learn the lesson of the Book of Eov and be spared, at least most of the pain associated with this. Now, I'd like to do two things before we conclude, even though we're out of time. What time is it? I know some of you have to go, but I think these conclusions are very important if you could stay just a couple more minutes. Number one, what are the practical implications of the Rambam's view? So, I once heard from Rav Tursky that he said that practically he thinks Rambam's limited hashkacha makes very little difference. Because even the Rambam would agree that Yisurin ban liadcha yifashvesh b'maisav. If a person experiences some type of mishap, so he doesn't know whether that's because of chance or it's because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was sending him an onesh or was sending him a wake-up call to change his actions. And even if it was happenstance, still yifashvesh b'maisav, because a person can reach a madrega in which they won't be subject to those types of yisurin and that type of teva. Meaning to say that it's pashut that if someone believes in an all-encompassing hashkacha, that everything that happens to a person happens because Hashem willed it to happen in a direct fashion. So obviously, if you experience yisurin, yifashvesh b'maisav. Maybe you would think that's not true once you acknowledge the existence of teva, that sometimes things happen to a person not due to a direct gzeira from Hashem. But Rav Tversky pointed out that's still not true. On a practical level, the result, the response to suffering, even for the Rambam, is identical. Yifashish maisiv, A, because it might have been a gzeira from Hashem, and B, even if it wasn't, you should be in a place where you don't experience such yisurin. So yifashish maisiv, which means either or both, connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on a more constant basis, such that you're not subject to yisurin, and B, learn to have the proper attitude such that yisurin won't cause you pain. And that's exactly what the Rambam writes in Hilchos Tainios. That's different also because it relates to the Tzibor, his personal correspondences, where he talks about how when you react to yisurin, it should be with tshuva. So that's point one. Point two is, we began last week by noting that perhaps some of Rambam's positions stem from his certain philosophical and scientific assumptions that we might no longer find compelling. At the same time, it's also true that the Rambam writes he arrived at his view through his understanding of Torah. It wasn't through philosophy. Adirabba, he rejects the Aristotelian approach. And as such, even if perhaps the Iker Mahalech on Hashkacha is not that of the Rambam, and we'll start talking about the other Mahalchim next week with Ramban, but the Rambam's position as well has to be taken very seriously and studied properly. It's no different than his Havanos and Bava Kama or Shabbos that come from the Torah, even if we don't paskin that way. And as such, I think, even though we spent 2-3 weeks doing it, I think it is very worthwhile to be ma'ayan in the Rambam's Mahalich and Hashgacha. So I said I would get back to your questions. So I don't want to be a liar. So I'm happy to take any questions now. For those of you who have to go, because I know we already went over, please. Yeah. Right.
There's somewhat of a combination of your personal interaction with Hashem and your misunderstanding of Hashem.
Right. Now, there's Rambam's writing that, I think the way he understood it was because, the only way, it was like cognitive dissonance, right? The only way for Eov to explain his suffering when he knew that he hadn't sinned was to adapt the view of Aristotle.
So would he say that Aristotle came to his view?
No, I don't know. Aristotle came to his view for however he did, because he had a certain conception of the universe by which miracles and hashgacha were by definition philosophically impossible. But Aristotle might have come to his view differently than Eov came to his view.
He is like a cop-out, essentially.
Okay.
I think, because of the fact that he didn't have such intellect and he viewed materialism.
Yeah, so he suffered incredibly, and he knew that it was unjust because he knew he didn't sin, and the only possible yishuv was lack of hashgacha. And then, among the friends who came and visited him, so some of them were totally wrong. They said, well, it must be that you did deserve that. Or it must be that it's just and you just don't know why. All sorts of things. And that, again, we didn't go through it, but if you read the Rambam's treatment of Eov, he goes through what was the dusiach, what was the conversation, the back and forth. Yeah. No, you had a question before?
Yeah, I was just confused with the direct and indirect form of what we were discussing. How we're defining that as it was from Hashem, or if it's coming from our logical.
If a person believes in God because that's what their parents told them, and that's what their teacher told them, and they've always just believed that through Masorah or the like. So that's indirect knowledge of God's existence. Direct knowledge of God's existence could be because Hashem told you, Shalom Aleichem, I exist, or it could be through philosophical proof and proving he exists.
Oh, those are both direct.
Sure. Yeah.
Didn't we say in like the first week that our knowledge of Hashem according to the Rambam cannot be possibly direct because we can't be masig?
No, he didn't say it can't be direct. He said it can't be complete. We can't understand Hashem's essence because we're limited and finite. But that doesn't mean to say that we can't prove his existence. And
that's
if
not
I prove,
knowledge of God, that's just
well,
a formulation.
No,
that's
formulation. My knowledge of his existence is direct. It's because I can prove it. Right? There's a big difference between saying, I know something because you told it to me, or I know something because I've proven it. So when you know something because you've proven it, it's direct. It doesn't mean it's complete. There are certain things we can know and we can prove. We can know God exists and prove it. We can know God is incorporeal and prove it. Does that mean that we know everything about HaKadosh Baruch Hu or understand his essence? Of course not.
So why is the Rambam saying you're not going to have Dofi Pleiim?
That's something else. That's saying that there... So there's a little bit... Again, there's more to that Rambam, but the Rambam says a couple things over there. Rambam there is not addressing how do we know God's existence. That he dealt with in Perek Aleph of Hilchos Sefer Torah, and he says we know it through proof, because if the spheres revolve, there must be a revolver. And the cosmological proof and the like. So God's existence we can know through proof. The Rambam in Parag Zion over there is dealing with a different issue. How do we know the truth of Torah? The truth of Torah can't be proven. I can't offer you a proof that shows you that Torah is true, meaning to say it comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? But what the Rambam says is, so how did the Bnei Yisrael know of the truth of Torah? It wasn't through the miracles. It wasn't through the brachim and the thunder and the lightning that accompanied Har Sinai and Maim at Har Sinai, because maybe that was just a great big magic show. What was it? It's because we heard the kol. We heard HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that experience, the experience of hearing Hashem's voice, is one that leaves a person with no doubt. Miracles, although very powerful, can leave a person with a tinge of doubt. You could still wonder, well, you know, I don't know how that happened, but who knows? Maybe it was magic. But when a person experiences, hears the call of Hashem, which all of Klal Yisrael did at Har Sinai, so then they're left with no doubt, because that's not something that could happen except if it were true.
They heard. How did that prove the truth of Torah?
Well, because they heard, like the Rambam says, they heard Hashem telling to Moshe or communicating this message, Lech emor lahem kach v'kach. Right, go tell Klal Yisrael the Torah. So accordingly, when Moshe told Klal Yisrael the Torah, Bnei Yisrael knew that that Torah that Moshe was teaching them was the Torah from Hashem, because they heard Hashem tell Moshe, Lech emor lahem kach v'kach. And that's different than if it was just a bunch of miracles, right? If it was just a bunch of fireworks at Sinai, but they hadn't heard Hashem say to Moshe, Lech emolam kach v'kach, so then there could have been a tinge of doubt as to the veracity of the Torah. Maybe Moshe was just a great magician, and maybe he was just making it all up. But when they heard Hashem communicate to Moshe, and they heard that directly, so that left them with no doubts. And that's the point that the Rambam is making. And that doesn't in any way disagree with what the Rambam says in Mor Nevuchim, what we mentioned today. Yeah, so go ahead. Either one.
Can we just chazer, what was the question of the Teretz regarding Rambam's understanding that Enochi and Lo'yeh are part of the Zayas?
Yeah, so the kasha was, there are five mitzvos in Enochi and Lo'yeh, right? Enochi Hashem Elokecha is one, Lo'yeh Elokecha Elimachim Elpanai, Lo Sishtachav Elohem is two, is three, Lo Savdeim is four, right? So why is it two and not five? Says the answer is that it didn't mean the words of the first two dibros. If it was the words of the first two dibros, then Anachanami should be five. It means the concept of the first two dibros. Anochi and Lo'yeh, which means God's existence and his power and his involvement in the world, and that nothing else exists besides God, or nothing else necessarily exists besides God. That's the yesod of Anochi and Lo Yeh, and those two principles were direct and not via Moshe, as opposed to everything else, which is via Moshe. Yeah.
Just would Ram assume what would the Ram say about the comparison between someone who, let's say, was misnabbed or had that direct experience compared to someone who came to recognition through like philosophical proof? Meaning that
with respect to, let's just say, knowledge of Hashem's existence, in a sense, there's no difference because it's direct knowledge.
You wouldn't assume there's any difference?
I don't know if there's no difference. There might be a difference, but qualitatively, they're both considered direct knowledge. I think that's the Ikar and Nakuda, as opposed to indirect knowledge. It happens to be that nobody would ever experience Nevuah until they've arrived at this obvious truth and gone way past that. But the point is that the knowledge, B'nai Yisrael's knowledge of Anochi and Lo Yeh, those Yisodos, were the same as Moshe's knowledge. Therefore, it wasn't Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, because it wasn't through Moshe that we knew that, it was directly. And that's the Yisod, because we knew it just like Moshe knew it. Moshe knew it directly, we knew it directly. We didn't need Moshe for that. We didn't need Moshe for Anochi. Well, we need Moshe to know that you're not allowed to wear shatnez.
Also, Stan was wondering, in terms of the Avergo, what exactly was the nature of that experience of Klai Yisrael for Anochi and Leichem Mor Lahem?
Pel Pa Davrigo was not said about
Klai Yisrael. What exactly was the nature of, were they all,
you're saying like they heard a voice?
With the Targema for that period?
No. So again, this is a more complex pro issue, but the Rambam explains
that
among the Vulchim,
sound that,
yeah, that's what it was. They heard the coil. They heard this undifferentiated sound, which was clearly and unambiguously prophetic, and allowed them to understand that that meant HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling to Moshe Rabbeinu Leicha Emor Lahem Kach V'Kach. But they weren't at a madrega where they were able to apprehend the words in a way, right? Mashal Amad Davar Dome. So let's say I speak to Shmuel in Portuguese. So, you don't understand Portuguese. And you might not even be close enough to hear the words that I'm saying. But you're able to see that I'm speaking to Shmuel. And that you're absolutely sure of. Even if you don't understand the words, and you don't even necessarily hear the words, though you see me talking to him, and you hear sounds coming from me to him. So, Klal Yisrael at Sinai, when they saw and experienced the kol, so they saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu communicating via prophecy to man. And that could be experienced even without being able to understand and differentiate each and every word. And that is the basis for Emunah, because they're having experienced that gave them certain knowledge that the Torah is Mipi Agvura.
The Ran in Drashos says that if a Tzadik goes into a, like the, I don't know if we spoke about this last week, I wasn't here.
No, we'll get to Ramban in the upcoming weeks.
The Ran Lapiansky felt this is the mainstream view that he's showing.
Which view?
That there's limited Hashkafah.
That might be true, but there's a very big difference between the Ramban.
Yeah, yeah.
And the Rambam, they both hold of limited hashkacha.
Well, like a tzaddik going into the
but there's a huge difference. Yeah, so Ran, there's a very big difference. We'll have a chance between Ramban, Rambam, and Ran. They all hold among Rishonim of limited hashkacha,
okay.
Meaning to say, when I say limited, I mean non all encompassing hashkacha.
Right.
But there's a very big difference between all three of their views, and that's why the Ramban critiques Rambam's view so carefully. Take a look at the Ramban in Drashas Tarsa Shem Tamima for his critique of the Rambam's Mahalich HaNashkacha. If you want to read for next week, I should have told everybody to do it. You should. Everybody should read the Rambans for next week that I have on the Makoro sheets.
They share
a lot of things. That's correct. It's not just Rav Elchanan. It's a very fascinating thing. It's most Achronim. It's not Rav Dessler. It's not Chazanish. It's not Rav Elchanan. It's not Ramchal.
Which is just interesting.
Well, that's a very good question. We'll also deal with in future weeks, which is, one second, please. Which is the why is it that the Achronim seem to reject the Rishonim, which is very unusual.
We're going to talk about it.
Yeah, of course. That's what's Hashem.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.